perfection,
mm-hmm.
we are after moderation, where the Imam says the peak of good management, it's the peak to have moderation
right.
in the management. So this is just one of the qualities.
Mm-hmm.
And with regards to management, people might say, you know, the thing is, we don't get the opportunity to do management in the Imam Bargah or Husseinia
mm-hmm.
or the
mm-hmm.
mosques and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
The solution to it is the person or the parent should go
mm-hmm.
to the head of the mosque or the Husseinia and should speak to the person in charge.
Mm-hmm.
Let my child involve my child as well.
In the banners, in the background, in cleaning, rather.
Exactly, yeah. And it's important for other people who got used to it. Like this person, ABC, who does this work every time, like distributing water,
is
with this person.
Yeah.
So the person has to be generous by stepping down for a while, for a few days, and allowing and encouraging other people, like other youths,
mm-hmm.
to do this work. This is how they are going to learn. If the people who are normally doing every time, if they sit over there and they do the same stuff every time, then how can other people learn management?
So that's the importance. Thank you, dear listeners. Thank you, Brother Liaquat, for sharing those useful insights with us. That was all the time we had for today. Thank you so much. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Eruba Shavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
This conference was one of the events organized to remember over 340 members of the Islamic movement who were murdered when soldiers of the Nigerian army attacked the home of Sheikh Ibrahim al-Zazaki and the worship center of the Islamic movement in December 2015. Participants at this conference described the 2015 Zaria massacre as a crime against humanity and of historic magnitude, which was committed by a few agents of the Nigerian state. Hundreds of men, women, and children were shot and buried in mass graves.
I lost 5 children, 3 of which are biological, 2 of which are adopted. They were orphans and we took them in and were taking care of them. The 5 of them have not been found. Nothing about them were heard of. We just don't know how to explain the situation because of the excruciating pain in our hearts.
Mourners said that identity, faith, and religious conviction cannot be erased through violence. Speakers affirm that the Islamic movement is deeply rooted in an enduring struggle for justice and an unwavering resistance to tyranny, forces that cannot be silenced or extinguished.
The Zaria massacre made our call known to the whole world. Remember, in all continents of the world, they were demonstrating, demanding our religion. We knew what happened. Remember, in India, it went to the extent that the Prime Minister of India was saying that, why don't you release that celebrity?
A decade after the heinous massacre in Zaria, members of the Islamic movement continue to await justice and the prosecution of those responsible. Human rights organizations argue that that the Nigerian government's attempt to conceal the atrocity reflects a profound disregard for human life and a blatant evasion of accountability.
We expected that indicted individuals and groups should be prosecuted, particularly the military commanders who gave the order. We also expected government, having been given the names and identities of the victim, to take steps towards restitution and compensation. Nothing has been done.
Participants at this conference said tyrants don't realize that abuse of power weakens their own system. They explained that moral leadership endures as the era of every political actor eventually finishes. Ranjim Abdullahi, Abuja.
South Koreans, together with workers from around the world, marked International Migrant Workers Day at Seoul Station on Sunday. Joining the demonstration was the father of a 25-year-old Vietnamese graduate of a South Korean university, Tu An, who died October 28th trying to evade an immigration crackdown.
The crackdown, which lasted over 3 hours, drove our daughter to her death. As a parent, I want to know the truth about what happened during her final moments on this earth.
The crackdown that claimed Tu An's life aimed to clean up the country prior to its hosting of APEC world leaders nearby.
All workers living in this land should be respected as human beings. No one should be forced to hide or run away in fear.
Nepali Udaya Rai came to South Korea 20 years ago. He suffered discrimination, workplace harassment, and unpaid wages, and says migrant workers' lives need consideration.
Neither employers nor the public understand the dire circumstances of migrant workers and often see them not as workers with rights, but as a temporary labor force to be used by capitalists.
There are about 1 million migrant workers in South Korea, and they do a large portion of the so-called 3D jobs, dirty, difficult, and dangerous. About 100 migrant workers are killed in workplace accidents here each year, and that's about four times the rate of South Korean workers.
Attitudes must change, says Udaya.
We must recognize migrant workers as fellow workers and members of society and strive together to protect their labor and human rights.
South Korean labor laws must also change, say critics, who point out that, among other problems, visas for migrant workers essentially tie them to one employer, suppressing their wages, options, and human rights. Frank Smith, Seoul.
A historic day in Iraq, as the Iraqi government officially announced the end of the mandate of the United Nations Assistant Mission for Iraq, UNAMI, after more than 20 years of its presence in the country. This comes in the light of improved security and political stability, which will allow Iraq to transition from direct international support to managing its own internal affairs.
In my view, the presence or absence of UNAMI mission makes no difference to Iraq, especially since this organization receives direct support. Unfortunately, most of the so-called international humanitarian organizations have turned into tools controlled by the United States. The evidence is clear. We have seen repeated interventions in Iraqi affairs. UNAMI had specific objectives, defined mandates, and legal and diplomatic mechanisms. But what we witnessed went beyond that, reaching direct political interference and intervention in Iraq's political decision-making.
Despite UNAMI's long presence in Iraq, political analysts believe the organization did not fulfill its true role. Instead, it influenced and interfered in political decisions, failed to manage affairs effectively, and consistently leaned toward the American side, failing to convey the suffering of the Iraqi people.
The truth is that the United Nations, through its representations worldwide in recent years, has failed miserably to be a clear mirror reflecting the suffering of people. Instead, it has turned into a tool in the hands of the United States of America. In Iraq, the UN representative reflected a specific agenda and exercised a form of imposed guardianship over the Iraqi state. As a result, the mission was only able to achieve the objectives pursued by the United States while attempting to place pressure on the Iraqi state.
This is a historic day for Iraq as UNAMI's mission ends and a new era begins, one characterized by the Iraqi sovereignty and the prevention of interference in internal affairs.
A new phase begins for Iraq with the end of the United Nations assistance mission in the country. This doesn't mean the end of cooperation with the UN and is aimed at further asserting Iraq's sovereignty without any foreign intervention. Nawar Faik, Baghdad.
In the midst of the Israeli regime's ongoing genocide in Gaza, a number of protesters have gathered outside the British Parliament to hold a special Christmas service in honour of all those killed in the Holy Land of Palestine. This vigil seeks to combine prayers for the people of Palestine with outrage at the British government's role in supporting the Israeli regime's genocide against those Palestinians. And attendees particularly want to draw attention to the treatment meted out to both Muslims and Christians by the Jewish extremists inside the Netanyahu administration. The protesters say that Western media and political elites deliberately obfuscate the existence of Palestinian Christians to make it easier to demonize the victims of Israel's genocide and label them as terrorists not worthy of being humanized.
There's been a lot of work done to basically depict Muslims as terrorists. No one talks about Christian terrorists or Jewish terrorists. When they think of that word, they automatically think Muslim. So that's why that framing exists right now. But we know Christians live in Palestine. We've had vicars talk about how their churches are being bombed. We know Israel attacks them. Even during last Christmas, I remember how churches were bombed into rubbles.
Members of different religious communities were in attendance to commemorate the victims of the genocide. Jewish pro-Palestinian groups concede that politicians like Bezalel, Smotrich and Itamar Ben-Gvir have deep support amongst the Jewish settlers occupying Palestine.
And their policies are neo-fascist. They talk about annihilating all the Palestinians, the women, the children, everybody. There's no reservation about it. And Netanyahu follows this partly because he's ideologically inclined.
With churches and mosques being destroyed by the Zionist Israeli regime in the birthplace of Jesus and hundreds of thousands of people murdered, it will take serious work to break through the pro-Israel propaganda and make wider Christian populations understand what's taking place in Palestine to those they claim are their brethren. Issa Kadhimi, London.
Coordinated protests against the administration of Donald Trump continue, with activists surrounding the White House to deliver a people's indictment against Trump. From the deployment of National Guard troops in American cities to unprecedented illegal immigration raids to the axing of federal funding of government departments, Trump has inspired some activists to remain in a mode of permanent protest.
I'm 76 years old. Okay, I was able to live in the Vietnam era where Nixon had to leave office, okay? Other countries through mass protests, like South Korea, other countries have like massively stood up and nonviolent, very compelling actions to really inspire people and disrupt the workings of what's going on nonviolently. And we can do that.
The protesters say their regular actions are to inspire millions of Americans to return to the nation's capital and nonviolently oust an administration they accuse of being fascist. Economic issues continue to mount in the United States, both structural, like inflation, housing, and healthcare costs, and new, like a Wall Street bust in the artificial intelligence boom. Just 31% approve of Trump's handling of the economy, which is his all-time low, and down from 40% as recently as March.
Because a lot of people don't believe in politics, don't address it, don't see it, but they do see what's happening in the pocketbook, in their own reality. And That's the first thing that people address, Americans address.
Trump's MAGA, or Make America Great Again, base is also showing signs of fracture due to his imperialist attacks on Iran, Gaza, and Venezuela, which contradict his promises to end Washington's foreign meddling and endless wars.
Trump's overall approval rating is 36%, which is down from 42% earlier this year, but which is still rather high for a Western head of state. However, his right-wing economic policies target the upper and not the working class, and he appears to be exacerbating rather than healing America's many cultural divides. Ramin Mazahiri, Washington, D.C.
For many Syrians, Israel's latest remarks reinforce a belief that the threat extends far beyond Syria's borders. The statement is widely viewed as an open declaration of hostility toward the region, rather than mere political rhetoric.
This entity threatens the entire Arab world, not just Syria or Palestine. We aren't afraid, but there must be a broader popular response, especially by Arabs. Sadly, people's reactions remain slow, while some governments align with Israel.
Syrians also connect these statements to recent Israeli incursions in the south, including the attack on Beit Jinn. Many view these events as early indicators of a dangerous shift that may eventually demand decisive action.
This regime won't stop at Palestine. It wants full control of the region in order to control all the resources of its people. It has been expanding in southern Syria for over a year now. Resistance is our natural and legitimate response by any means available.
Palestinians see that any confrontation with Israel is part of their struggle, as they have always shared destiny with Syrians. They considered this a common struggle.
We must confront this enemy. We know from our experience as Palestinians that it only responds to force and retreats only when pressured. Diplomacy and agreements have no effect because its nature is rooted in violence. As people and governments, we must resist until all occupied lands, from the Golan to Palestine, are reclaimed.
From Damascus to the southern countryside, Syrians say these threats only strengthen their sense of unity and resolve. As tensions rise, many insist they are prepared to face any challenge to their sovereignty and future. Ali Muhammad, Damascus.
In Tehran, excitement is running high as the 19th Cinema Verite International Documentary Film Festival has opened its doors. Screenings have begun, drawing filmmakers, critics, and enthusiasts.
This year's festival presents a wide range of films with diverse themes, which is one of its main strengths. 68 films compete in the national section, and nearly 70 take part in the international section. We have also added a new category focusing on Iran, its rich history, and the 12-day war. Many of the strongest works we receive belong to this section.
One of the most remarkable features of this year's festival is the unprecedented presence of some of the most iconic documentary figures. With fresh visual styles and bold storylines, their works represent the new generation shaping the future of nonfiction cinema. The festival's international section this year stands out for its high-profile selections.
I submit to this festival because I read in their website they have this very strong care about human rights and children's rights, also about women filmmakers. So that's why I decided to submit, and then they select my film for the it's in the international competition.
Meanwhile, the Iranian section also reflects the nation's recent history.
This festival is the highest-ranking documentary festival in Iran and enjoys international prestige. That is why I chose to premiere my film here. It is a biographical documentary about a man with a clear vision, someone who left a lasting impact not only on our region, but far beyond.
This year's edition is defined by diversity. Works shaped by social issues, human stories, wartime experiences, and innovative visual approaches.
With celebrated veterans, ambitious newcomers, and international premieres, the 19th Cinema Verite Festival sets the stage for one of the most competitive and closely watched editions yet. Hisoom Shah Mahdi, Tehran.
Thank you. This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, how to get fit. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, welcome to 8:30 on I'm Bin Shredi with me, Sister Zainab, and obviously the keeping fit. Now, this is a topic that I think is hugely under-addressed, and it's actually hugely important. And look, before I go into detail there, look, the reason is that, yeah, I think many of us forget that one of the greatest blessings we're given, in a sense, apart from youth, and obviously we're told that, you know, it's one of the things that we don't really value youth until we've lost youth. And then obviously one other thing that we probably don't value enough until we've lost it, and that is good health. And many of us, a majority of us, are born with decent, with good health. And then, you know, as we grow up, as we become young adults, we just sort of take it for granted for quite a long time, I suspect, because, hey, we're still feeling healthy. In our 20s and 30s, we feel healthy. But then maybe when people start, you know, they have their families, their kids are maybe sort of still young or even teenagers, and then they realize that, hey, where's the energy gone? And look, everything that Allah gives us, so whether it's our mind, whether it's particular talents we're given, and some people, for example, have talents with languages, some people have talents with their hands, some people are so talented that they can become their country's top mathematicians, top scientists. You know, all of us have special skills and talents that Allah gave us, and that we, inshallah, we're all nurturing and developing further. But, you know, health is also one of them. We cannot neglect it. And I tend to always myself say, well, you know, we're meant to be servants of Allah. Anyway, obviously Allah wants us, and we can't really serve. Allah needs nothing from us, so we should be serving here in this temporary life, this temporary world. So we should serve our community, we should serve other people, we can serve nature, we can serve environment, contribute there. And there's one very vital aspect to be able to be a good servant. Welcome back to Aid Said here, and I'm being trained with me, Sister Zainab. And so obviously I've just mentioned there's one vital aspect to being a good servant of Allah, and that is having good health is actually very vital and very useful. Because obviously you can imagine for yourself that if you don't take care of your health, your lifespan is going to be shortened. Now, just from the point of view of being a good servant of Allah, obviously that means you cannot be a good servant of Allah for quite as long. And in a sense, I would even add in that if you're not looking after your health, often on the contrary, you have habits that are harmful, that common knowledge and common sense nowadays would say it's harmful for health. And may I say, yes, I will mention things such as smoking. We all know, none of us can escape the knowledge that smoking is okay, I'm fine, I'm healthy. No, we know. Doctors, medicine, science confirms it nowadays. It's not good for us. So A, it's going to cut short our life and make part of our life more difficult because we might get very ill because of it. And, you know, secondly, to actually do that to ourselves, to harm ourselves, surely that is a very bad thing. Allah, it would not really, we don't really have the right to damage ourselves knowingly because everything is given to us by Allah. So, also just want to mention some of the things that one of the famous martyrs from Uhud defense, Ibrahim Hadi, did, because for him, being fit was actually very important. So he understood this very well. See, for example, was a good sports player, and he would actually give advice in terms of fitness. So at one point, he gave very unusual advice. He said, for example, so he was bringing faith and sort of health together, and they do go together. He said that if you want to get in shape, first of all, you should choose good friends and not go astray. And you should live a healthy life and not be corrupt. And to be successful in sports, You have to turn to God and live a healthy life. So there's a lot in there. So good friends, stay on the path, not become deviated, not be corrupt. So I'm going to leave that there, all these other aspects, and just emphasize again and again, if we're on the straight path and we have this in terms of akhlaq, very good and beautiful life, but we're neglecting our physical health or even our mental health, now that is, we really need to make some changes then. So I pray that all of us can make the changes that we need to. And that was it for today, and farewell for now. And I look forward to welcoming you to another episode of HZ here on Iron Boomish Radio. Thank you very much for listening to this episode of A to Z. And for more information, please also visit our website at www.iranradio.ir.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
Iran Radio presents some interesting facts about the Holy Quran. The word Bismillah appears 114 times in the Quran. It occurs twice in chapter An-Naml, whereas chapter Tawbah is the only surah which does not begin with Bismillah. Quran believes in life after death, and the Quran teaches us that besides having a body, a human being also has a spirit, a soul. And when a person dies, the physical body vanishes, while the soul remains. We start this hour's lineup with leader's speech. The program presents a selection of the statements and speeches of the honorable leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Khamenei. Then it's time for a spotlight. The program covers the most important events happening in the world today with roundtable analysis and discussion. And our final program this hour is our varied radio productions feature.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
The following is part of the speech delivered on April 27, 2017 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the Supreme Leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the participants of the 34th International Quran Competitions. You should look at Islamic governments and Islamic countries and see in what condition they are in the face of the US, Zionism, the enemy and looters. This results from drifting away from the Quran. If we get close to the Quran, all these voids will be filled and all these rifts will be closed. If this happens, the Islamic identity will show itself in the face of evil-based identity. When we say that if we act on the Qur'an, life will improve, this is what it means. Qur'anic concepts exist, but they should be turned into public discourses among people. They should be repeated, worked on, and researched into until they become well-established beliefs in the Islamic community. Poets, literary personalities, and artists should keep writing and doing artistic work on them, till they become well-established beliefs in the Islamic community. This is not impossible. this is not improbable. They should not think that if we want to carry out such tasks, it will take 100 years. This is not the case. If those who love Islam and religion show determination, these tasks will be accomplished very soon. We should pursue the Quran like this.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Thankfully, in the Islamic Republic, our achievements in getting close to the Quran have not been few in number. We used to be very distant from the Quran. During the time of the Taghuti rule, the Quran was completely isolated in the country. There was no trace of the Quran in our schools, in primary schools and in schools for adults, high schools and universities. There was no trace of the Quran in our society. There were a number of Quranic meetings, but they were rare. We had seen examples of such meetings up close in Tehran, Mashhad, and other cities, and we had heard about similar meetings in other cities. A group of people would gather together, recite the Quran, and that was it. Memorizing the Quran, reciting it in a continuous manner, and promoting Quranic teachings were very rare. However, the revolution helped us get close to the Quran. It familiarized us with the Quran. Today, we are proud that we are interested in and fervent with the Quran. We are proud that our youth are interested in the Quran.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
Chased by wolves, followed by a hawk. On the battlefield, you took your final walk. It took my breath when you said goodbye. But then again, heroes never die. Your final words were stay the course. Trust in God, the everlasting source. Don't give in to the enemy's plots. Resist with faith, go against the odds. Your way I follow, oh my hero. Unbreakable soul, unstoppable power. Until the last breath, you never surrender. Unshakable faith, unwavering sacrifice. Make you the hero we'll remember forever. Your blood was spilled, but it nourished my roots. I then became a tree with men. Love, courage, and resolve. You've made me
Out from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to the Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashemi. Thanks so much for being with us. As the Israeli regime continues to break its ceasefire agreements in both Gaza and Lebanon, anti-occupation leaders reiterate that resistance is the only way to confront Zionist aggression. What happens when guarantors of the agreements are also part of the problem? Do the Israelis want full-scale wars again? Well, the Secretary General of Hezbollah says surrender is never an option, and the resistance will not disarm. What lies ahead for the region? Stay with us as we take a look at this on the Spotlight. I'd like to welcome my guests to the program. Zed Marshall, international law expert and geopolitical analyst out of Geneva. And Batu Sabeti, activist and political analyst out of London. Well, thank you both for being with us. Let's start it off in London. And Batul, the Israeli regime is currently breaking two ceasefire agreements. I mean, do you think that this is overall part of the regime's strategy to basically agree to the ceasefires in hopes that global attention to its crimes would become less, while at the same time continuing with its killings?
Yes, good evening to you, Marzia, and to your guests and all your viewers. It's not necessary that the policy of the Israeli occupation entity is necessarily matching that of America. At the end of the day, it is America that imposed the ceasefire in both countries, and the Israeli occupation entity, as we know, it wishes to move as it wills, and we see that effectively the ceasefire is not a reality in both Lebanon and in Gaza, in the sense that it's continuously being broken. And actually, the Israeli occupation entity is emboldened in many ways because it knows that right now, in this current phase, the resistance will not per se enter into a direct open war with it, because it's not in its interests to do so, as it is restructuring and recuperating itself in what is now just one pit stop within a much broader and longer battle in this region to ultimately liberate it. So I believe that the Americans support a kind of negotiation under fire. That's their current strategy right now. It is one of closing the direct open wars. Without necessarily having that open war, it wants to achieve what could not be achieved essentially within 2 years of direct open war, whether that's in Gaza or, as we know, last year in Lebanon for those 66 days. So the Israeli occupation entity is fulfilling its interests to a minimum extent at a time in which it knows that the resistance won't respond. But ultimately, Israel cannot go outside of the American dictates in causing an all-out war. If it wants to do that, then it has to get the American position ultimately. And we've been seeing a series of escalations since the ceasefire last year on the 27th of November. We saw the peak of the escalation that occurred last month with the assassination of the chief of staff of the resistance in Lebanon. And it must be said that the resistance right now, its lack of response shouldn't be mistaken as its lack of a willingness to respond to the entity. Ultimately, it's preparing for something much greater, and that's for the next war. And that won't be like this current war. And I believe, you know, this current phase is about, you know, closing these direct open wars and not opening new ones.
So, Batul, are you saying basically that the ceasefire was forced upon the Israeli regime by the Americans, and right now the Americans have given them a way that they can basically continue their aggression, but having the other side abide by the ceasefire, or what exactly are you saying there?
Right, so what I'm saying is there's a limit to the extent in which Israel transgresses. So America is happy with Israel transgressing as long as there's no reaction from the other side. But ultimately, it is playing with fire here, because what constitutes an aggression so large, such as to start a direct open war? So there's a tipping point. America's ideal is negotiations under fire. It wants to pressure the resistance and get the resistance to a point of disarmament where Israel failed to do so through a direct open war. And that is to turn the government in Lebanon against the resistance. But it's quite hard to do so, or let's say the Lebanese government doesn't exactly have the argument to do so when Israel's transgressions are so ongoing and continuing. So there's a certain tipping point over here. But what's clear is that Israel, through its direct open wars, both in Gaza and Lebanon, has failed to achieve what its primary goal was, and that's to disarm the resistance and achieve this quote-unquote new Middle East project. So that has clearly failed. America's thinking, what is the next option? Let's assess new strategies, and that's to turn it into an internal front. So in Gaza, it's to get the International Stabilization Force to disarm the resistance in Gaza, to locate the tunnels, to restructure the PA. Essentially, where Israel failed, it's to get the internal fronts to carry out that dirty work.
All right. Well, I'm going to stay with you, Batul. I'm waiting for Sayed Moaz to join us. I mean, when we look at Batul, oh, Sayed Moaz, I have you. Can you hear me? Okay. I think we're still having some audio difficulties. Sayed Moaz, can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear
okay,
you.
Okay. I saw a nodding of the head, so that was a good sign. Thanks so much for joining us. When we look at the overall situation that is taking place, whether we're talking about in Gaza or we're talking about in Lebanon, we get to the point we have those guarantors of the ceasefires. How complicit, Sayed Moaz, do you see these guarantors? What should they be doing, and what is not happening right now as the Israeli aggression continues in both places?
Well, thank you for having me. Sorry for that technical difficulty earlier. The thing is, you know, these guarantors need to be able to do the basics, and sometimes they're not even able to do that. And that's what brings a lot of these questions into these ceasefires, and why some commentators have, again, called it you cease and I will continue to fire. And that's how Israel has changed the development around there. I just came from Doha Forum where this was being discussed, and, you know, there never was a time to discuss about humanitarian aid and access to humanitarian aid as a conversation piece in negotiations. This was supposed to be something that's given anyways. The fact that you have guarantors that are discussing this as a potential negotiating piece clearly shows the one-levelness on this side in favor of Israel. There should be no question as to these basic humanitarian needs. And so what guarantee can we get from people who are negotiating humanitarian access? This is really appalling to begin with, the starting point. And if you even knew the British scholar who actually put the design for this, they're apparently using his playbook. He even came out and condemned America and saying that this is incorrect to use it in this manner. So even the academics and the people in the international community who are working in humanitarian affairs clearly see what these deals are for. They're never in reality for what they're supposed to be, which is ceasefire. They don't have the basics of even that. So the guarantors are one-sided. We do not have parties to this these agreements or these ceasefires that want a serious end to the violence and to put serious restrictions on Israel, who happens to be the main person in this entire either ceasefire in Gaza or in Lebanon that seems to be violating that. And What are the consequences of that? That's something that the guarantors have to show, the consequences that Israel will get as a result of violating these ceasefires.
Well, let's talk about that. Staying with you, said Maz, the consequences. I mean, so far, we haven't seen the consequences, but at the same time, people continue to be killed, both in Gaza and Lebanon. Let me also add to that the West Bank even. So what are the consequences? And at the end of the day, if there are no consequences, then tell me about what exactly it means to have these type of agreements and the guarantors.
I hate to sound very bleak, but that your question is very a striking one, and that's something that us academics, we're really looking at into now. I mean, for example, this idea of lack of humanitarian access to these locations by the Israeli authorities is essentially genocidal intent. Amnesty International came out last month with a very brazen report suggesting that just because it's a ceasefire, the continued prevention of humanitarian aid access to people in need is a genocidal intent. And that's what it is. Israel is in this Eretz Israel project. They want to take over this entire area. Netanyahu has been blatant about this repeatedly. Smotrich and others who have his allies, they make it very clear that this is what they want. Now, what sort of consequences? I mean, in the Amnesty International report, for example, they're talking about bringing ICC charges, which we know have already happened with Netanyahu and Gallant, but so far no real meaningful action. I mean, just right now, the ICC had a gathering in which they were seeking their support. Some of their judges have been sanctioned. I just met Francesca Albanese. I mean, can you imagine a UN rapporteur who's just reporting the truth has gets sanctioned and she has difficulty just functioning basics? So there are a few of us who are obviously in the international humanitarian affairs, human rights, but again, countries have to step up, and particularly Muslim countries who seem to have gone toe-in-toe with Mr. Trump. This is great, okay, but you need to be able to push back and get some serious guarantees. And if you cannot get guarantees of basic human rights, basic humanitarian access, the prevention of continued warfare, which Israel continues to do, this is not a ceasefire. This is a continuance of war.
Well, Batou, what does it mean? I mean, as a previous guest said, it's a continuation of war. It sounds good. People are talking about possibilities and of course, that there should be guarantees to allow the humanitarian supplies to enter, but at the same time, as we're speaking, people continually, they're dying, they're being killed, they're being starved to death in Gaza. I mean, the head of Hamas, Khalil al-Hayya, has said that armed resistance and bearing arms remains the right of the Palestinian struggle against the Zionist occupation, obviously stressing that resistance is the only way, and they will not lay down their weapons. I mean, your thought about that comment at this point in time, who was it meant for, and what does it mean exactly in your perspective?
Absolutely. This is the line of resistance, and that is where there is occupation. Resisting is an inherent right. In fact, international law gives that very right, and it's a very natural phenomenon that actually there is a spontaneous reaction to every action. So that is a given right that occurs naturally within the phenomenon of nature's power even, and that's every action leads to a kind of reaction. So when the extent of the permissibility of practicing aggression and committing atrocities, as you've just mentioned, and actually the complete transgression on every human rights occurs, it's very natural to see this kind of resistance, and the legitimacy of that resistance is garnered due to the very action of the enemy. So what if you have every kind of aggression, occupation, and complete transgression combined? You know, so it is not natural for there to be no resistance, you know, based on the extent of the transgression that we're seeing. But you mentioned the superpowers over here and the guarantors. Ultimately, what matters to them in all of this is not securing the rights of the people or their state of being or the allowing of international aid or any of that. What matters to them is for the region ultimately to suit their interests. So right now, they don't want it to turn into an open war. They don't want major instability right now. They let Israel do what it wants right now within that certain limit that we've described, and that is that Israel's targeting of resistance targets in Lebanon should be such that it doesn't go beyond select targets and lead to an open war, because ultimately they want these negotiations to continue whilst under pressure. So it's negotiations under fire. and the guarantors of the ceasefire, US and France, absolutely play no role in safeguarding the rights of the people. In fact, it's the opposite. They allow Israel to do what it wants without opposing. I mean, Tom Barak said this clearly with one word. That is, we cannot and do not wish to pressure Israel. Same words of Lindsey Graham. He went to the extent of saying, even if the resistance to Lebanon is disarmed, we cannot control Israel, i.e. it can do whatever it wants. It can turn even into a Syria model where you negotiate and concessions are given, all the concessions of the world. You do exactly what Israel wants, but at the same time, we can target every weapons depot in the country and completely strip away your sovereignty and maintain our very presence and occupy your land, essentially. So that means that there's been zero adherence, the complete opposite of what the US claims. It's backing and justifying everything Israel can do, and we know with the press of a button, it can stop Israel from its actions. Worse than that, what Israel does, its attacks for Lebanon, is being used as a pressure against Lebanon to do what Israel failed to do. So if Israel failed to disarm the resistance, then the Israeli attacks are used to pressure Lebanon to get it to disarm via the government. And we know that the resistance has given its weapons south of the Litani. That's something that the Secretary General has come out and said, and reaffirmed the statements from the UN to that effect. So the guarantors turned things from an all-out war to negotiations under fire. That's essentially what we're seeing right now in the region compared to the status quo before, and that is all because an open war did not reach its goals, and that is because the resistance, may I add, is still strong, aka it's not been defeated.
All right. Well, Said Maaz, Secretary General of Hezbollah, Sheikh Naim Bassem, has said that, talking to the Lebanese, that those who are helping the enemy to look at what has happened to Syria and understand what the enemy wants for Lebanon, which is an entity under direct Israeli control and destruction of Lebanon. Your thoughts, what can the Lebanese, what should the Lebanese learn from Syria?
No, absolutely. I think that's well said, that they're going to occupy a piece of Lebanon. Let's not beat around the bush about it. That's exactly the plan. That is Eretz Israel. That is working towards Eretz Israel. And that's something that's been very clear from the Israeli agenda. So Lebanese people, look at their country for the last time with those borders, because that southern part of that border, Israel is going to take. And then once they eat that, they're going to eat the rest, and it's going to be a continuous process, which has been going on since 70 years, ever since this Zionist project has been allowed to flourish in this area. Now, that's exactly what's happening in Syria, where they've taken over this land, and they're not going to give it back. This idea, and they're using this idea of one minority playing it against another minority. And this is the strategy that Israel's been used. Over there, they've supported the Christian minorities or the Druze communities, where in actuality, those Druze were the very first people to be part of the rebels. So it's kind of just using one party to another and to get their ends to meet. And Lebanese people need to realize that, you know, you have to come together. This is the defense and sovereignty of your nation. And what's really sad is that, what I think is very, a point that, you know, my colleague mentioned, Batul, is about the resistance. Let's be clear here. Hezbollah goes away today. Hamas goes away today. The resistance is not going to end. Because the issues behind why the resistance exists, those inequities will still exist, and people will raise their banner to resist against the Israeli Zionist project.
Okay.
And that's something that that people need to realize, that that's not going to happen. And just one last point before you continue is that what we see out of Europe, when we talk about you regionally, look what they're doing to Russia. I mean, they unilaterally just froze all the assets of the Russians just last week, right? And a ceasefire hasn't even occurred. So, I mean, when we talk about tools that are available for these very countries who talk about, oh, we support Palestine, we recognize Palestine, it's time to actually do more. And you are doing it in certain cases for Ukraine. And this sort of hypocrisy and double standard is actually clearly destroying the international legal framework as we know it today. So, for God's sakes, please stop doing that. And for Muslim countries to step up and follow pursuit, because this is our region. The Arab countries need to come together and realize that just like regionally EU is dealing with the Ukrainian issue, the Arab countries need to come together more solidly and give a response that we're not